loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, in one of the most important diplomatic breakthroughs in a generation, the leaders of North and South Korea met yesterday and pledged to denuclearize the peninsula and to formally end the Korean War. Even the most optimistic observers were surprised at the scope of the meeting, which took place on the South Korean side of the border at Panmunjom, the demilitarized zone. President Trump later issued a statement saying that he was looking forward to meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in the coming weeks or months. And then on our regular Friday segment covering the upcoming midterm elections and the big social and political issues that are part of this campaign, or should be, we take a look at a series of upcoming special elections, a Republican win in Arizona, the possibility of Ohio Governor John Kasich running against Donald Trump in the Republican primaries, and we take a look back and look at the big picture of the trajectory of American politics.
And in other headlines, for the fifth day in a row, Israeli forces continued their repression of Palestinian protesters participating in demonstrations along the border between Israel and Gaza. At least three Palestinians have been killed and more than 600 wounded, with over 150 being shot. The weekly demonstrations will culminate on May 15th when Palestinians mark Nakba Day. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort's lawsuit challenging the authority of special counsel Robert Mueller has been thrown out by a district court judge. Manafort contended that the scope of Mueller's investigation was too broad to be considered legally valid. Manafort faces charges related to money laundering and failure to register as a foreign agent. Newly confirmed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Brussels, where he attended a NATO foreign ministers summit. From there, Pompeo will continue on to Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. The Iran nuclear deal, the Syria war, and the opening of the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem are expected to be main topics of discussion between Pompeo and foreign leaders. Teachers in Arizona are continuing to strike for a second day. Huge crowds, as many as 50,000 people, rallied in the state capital of Phoenix demanding higher pay for all school workers and increased funding for the state's education system. The strike in Arizona comes amid a wave of teacher activism, especially in West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, and Colorado. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion on the historic inter-Korean summit. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and clear.
But first, we turn to the very historic talks between the leadership in North and South Korea. And one of the most important diplomatic breakthroughs in a generation, the leaders of North and South Korea met yesterday and pledged to denuclearize the peninsula and to formally end the Korean War. We are joined from Columbus, Ohio, by Gregory Ilitch. He is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. And we're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. Tim Beal's most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Greg and Tim, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's pretty historic. Tim Beal, I mean, the images of Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in stepping across back and forth, in fact, first going to the southern part.
That's right, yeah.
And then stepping back to the northern part together over that little step right at right in Panmunjom at the DMZ, the demilitarized zone. It said a lot, symbolically, of course. What were your reactions and what do you think's coming?
Well, to some extent, it's no surprise. Both sides have been committed to this summit. The South especially has been going full out to, you know, bring in all the showbiz aspects of it. Kim, we know, and the rest of his family have a lot of charm and persona. In that sense, it's not surprising. We've got, but if it is, as you say, very, very historic. It's a bit reminds me a bit of You know, the first moon landing is a small step for the large step for humanity, that sort of thing. So it is very much freighted with symbolism. But the key question, as you mentioned, is really what it leads on to.
Okay. And Gregory Ilitch, again, your reactions, of course, symbolism, of course, creating certain imagery, but it's not simply symbolic. I have my own views, but I want to hear yours. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, of course, there's, first of all, the very real emotional element that's unavoidable. And I think that's going to help change the narrative so that no matter what the Trump administration may choose to do in the future, it's going to have, if it wants to go in a more warlike direction, it's going to have to work a lot harder to build up justification for that. And that's a big plus for the Korean people and actually people in the world. But I think part of the Panmunjom declaration that's most interesting to me actually is the economic aspect. So it looks like they want to, the two Koreas want to reactivate old and abandoned economic agreements that previous conservative presidents in South Korea killed off. And I think that has that economic integration has a very real prospect of ensuring that peace stays in place. And I think that also will lead, because they're also talking about reconnecting the railway along the Eastern Corridor, and that would allow South Korea to ship goods across North Korea and into Russia and all the way to Western Europe. South Korea would gain transit fees, which would help its economy. I think the entire region stands to gain if this goes in that direction. And I think that would also make China and Russia more resistant to U.S. pushes for more sanctions if that gets established.
Can either of you envision North Korea actually giving up its nuclear weapons? I mean, we had South Africa after the post-apartheid government came in, and they said, the South African government under Mandela said, we don't want nuclear weapons. And so South Africa, which had nuclear weapons, got rid of them. Ukraine, at a completely different reason, also eliminated its nuclear weapons. I'm not aware of any other nuclear weapon state having taken back or gotten rid of nuclear weapons. Is it possible? Go ahead, Tim.
Well, no, my feeling is that it isn't. You're quite right. Nobody has, no government under threat has given up nuclear weapons because, of course, it is the ultimate deterrent. So it's very difficult to see this happening. Personally, I think the phrase denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula that North Korea has been using is not a good one because, I mean, the real objective is peace. Nuclear weapons are a result of the lack of peace, a result of the threat of war and so forth. So the emphasis should be on peace and how to achieve that rather than getting sidetracked as we are on the question of nuclear weapons. So I think there's going to be a lot of fudging at the subsequent U.S. Negotiations. And Trump, we understand, thinks that he's going for a surrender ceremony, but he's not going to. He's going to have to negotiate. And exactly what he's going to negotiate, how he's going to guarantee the security of North Korea under some form of limitation of nuclear weapons is really the key thing. It's the devil in the detail.
Greg Ilitch, there was an op-ed this morning that ran on CNN.com saying once everybody gets over the excitement, reality is going to set in, and that it is just simply not in the U.S.'s interest for there to be peace between North Korea and South Korea, because real denuclearization means that the U.S. can no longer allow its nuclear-powered and nuclear-armed ships into South Korean ports, and that that's going to be unacceptable to Pentagon policymakers. Do you think that's true?
No, I don't see the connection whatsoever. I mean, the United States is at peace with how many different nations across the world, and it hasn't deterred it from sending ships here, there, putting bases all over the world. I don't see the connection. But it does reveal a panic by Washington elites and the media that it could lead to pressure from the Koreans to remove the U.S. Forces stationed there. I don't see that happening. You know, the U.S. military is not in the habit of respecting the wishes of any people. And no matter what any Korean thinks, I think U.S. Forces Korea is there to stay. So if you look at the National Defense Strategy document from early this year, it talks about phrases like dynamic force employment and increased strategic flexibility and freedom of action. It wants to broaden the concept of where particular military forces are stationed. They don't have to be limited to that. They can strike out from there anywhere. Looking at Washington think tank policy documents from the last dozen years or so, they repeatedly say that U.S. Forces Korea shouldn't be restricted to the Korean Peninsula. They should be able to intervene anywhere, strike out and intervene anywhere in Asia. And I think so. For that reason, as well as being part of the stranglehold on China, this is a fear that the Washington establishment is not going to actually see take place, unfortunately, because there's nothing I would love more than to see the U.S. forces leave the Korean Peninsula. And I think most Korean people would prefer that as well.
I'll leave it to the Washington Post to really try to pour cold water on what's happening. And I think for the reasons that our guests are stating, the Post, in fact, represents at least one strong faction within the U.S. Political establishment that is very, very much opposed to peace breaking out in Korea. Here's the headline. After we see these dramatic images, Kim Jong-un, Moon Jae-in stepping across that dividing line at the DMZ, the Post article, everybody else, like the Times, even the Wall Street Journal, it's above the fold, big picture. For the Post, it's under the fold, small picture. The main article is on page A16, and the headline is North Korea's Kim suddenly projecting image of statesman. And then subtitle, his belligerent threats are replaced by a drive for diplomacy. I want to read a couple sentences. It's amazing. Forget about Kim Jong-un, the nuclear-armed tyrant threatening to nuke Washington and take out U.S. military bases in Asia. Here comes Kim Jong-un, the international statesman. That's the first paragraph. On Friday morning, the 34-year-old leader of North Korea, a man widely predicted 7 years ago to be incapable of keeping control of the world's most authoritarian state, walked across the line that divided Korea. And then it goes on to talk about the fact that Kim Jong-un, and yesterday they used a quote, in the fifth paragraph of this article, I want to read this, John, and have our guests respond. It's amazing. Quote, he's the master of the bold gesture, said Gary Samore, a nuclear nonproliferation expert at Harvard Kennedy School, who served as President Barack Obama's National Security Council. We've almost forgotten the bracket allegations that he had his half brother killed with a chemical weapon just last year, and that he had his uncle ripped apart with anti-aircraft guns. Now, in the earlier iteration of this story, the word allegations bracketed wasn't there. The word fact, we had forgotten the fact that he killed his half-brother with a chemical weapon and had his uncle ripped apart with anti-aircraft guns. Now, this is the Washington Post. Those are all in the first five paragraphs at this historic moment.
The country's newspaper of record.
Yeah, showing that they don't want this. Go ahead, Tim.
No, obviously they don't. Can I pick up the point that Greg mentioned? And that, of course, is China. So it's not we're not merely talking about Korea. We are talking very much about China and to some extent to Russia. And if we cast our minds back, I mean the whole business started in 1945 with the division of the Korean Peninsula by the United States initiative. Basically to protect its new possession of Japan from contagion from the Asian mainland. In those days, of course, it's the Soviet Union, because they still sort of control the government of China. And then, of course, China became the big issue. So we have to bear that in mind all the time. These strategic imperatives are there, and you see them sort of bubbling to the surface, I guess, in the Washington Post article you've just read. No, they don't want peace. That doesn't necessarily mean they want war, but but they certainly want to keep a sense of tension and threat. And so, yeah, they will be unhappy about any movement towards peace between the two Koreas, and they will, through various means, attempt to sort that.
Greg Ilitch, you know, I think most people won't know, but you know, how it came to be that Korea was actually divided. In 1945, in August, 5 days before Japan surrendered, Dean Rusk, we'll remember his name, and Charles Bonesteel, two young American government officials, looked at a National Geographic map and decided to draw a line across Korea using the National Geographic map.
Oh, my goodness.
That would divide Korea between a Soviet zone of control and an American zone of control. And thus, Korea and the Korean people, who have been a unitary people literally for thousands of years, were divided by these two young government officials by using a National Geographic map. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, so that's right. The Soviet Union entered the war against Japan towards the end as a way of repaying the West for the U.S. and for the D-Day Western Front. And so the Soviet troops were actually in the area long before the United States troops were. Actually, U.S. troops weren't there until after the end of the war. And the agreement was that both sides would have a temporary occupation there for Koreans to establish their own government. There's supposed to be an election across the entire peninsula with one Korea. That's not how the United States wanted it, and they installed their hand-picked puppet, Syngman Rhee, who proceeded to carry out mass slaughters of South Korean leftists, and he suppressed people's committees that had risen up spontaneously to self-organize local governments and unions. So the Soviet Union did leave as the agreement had specified, and here we are decades later, and the United States is still there.
Yeah, 30,000 U.S. troops. Go ahead, Greg. Sorry.
Yeah, and actually, I'd like to, if you don't mind, switch back to the question that you asked Tim previously on the Washington Post quote.
Sure, go ahead.
That kind of emotive language, of course, is intentionally intended to bypass rational analysis and get people to react in an emotional manner, and then they're more likely to support whatever hostile policy you want to put into action. As far as Kim Jong-nam, Kim Jong-un's half-brother, that's really an open question as to exactly who was behind it or not. Apparently, he had been in contact with a U.S. Intelligence official. Jang Song-taek, Kim Jong-un's uncle, was accused. I don't know I haven't seen the evidence, so who knows if it's true or not, but he was accused of corruption and planning a coup and a number of other measures. And of course, I'm against the death penalty, but there's something ironic about a U.S. newspaper complaining about the death penalty in another country. How many prisoners are executed in the United States? And if this is supposed to be a reason not to negotiate with North Korea, then what are we supposed to say about the thousands of people that U.S. drone strikes have murdered? What are we supposed to say about the something like 2,000 people who are killed by police every year? If this is a reason not to negotiate, then I think the North Koreans have just as good a case.
Yes.
But this is typical of the one-sided way the mainstream media present issues.
Yeah, and also, John, you know, Americans can't actually go to North Korea. They used to be able to go.
Yeah, and you've been several times.
I've been several times, and I also organized something called Korea Peace Tours, which took two delegations in the 2 years just recently of Americans, and the last one being a group of American educators, so that they could go to North Korea and see it for themselves. Instead of just hearing demonizing language, go and see the country. Because, you know, seeing is believing. You can go and get a sense of the place. Tim, one of the things that I think a lot of people in the United States probably thought was that North Korea was on its last legs, that it's everybody's starving to death. And as a consequence, the North Koreans would be forced to come to the table as a result of economic sanctions. But that's actually not what's happening. Donald Trump might want to, thump his chest and say, I did this. It's me being tough that did this. But it seems to me that what we're really witnessing is that the North Korean government and the South Korean government are creating so much momentum between them that, as we talked about earlier in the show, it becomes hard for somebody like Donald Trump or Mike Pompeo or John Bolton to intervene and stop a process. In other words, momentum gives an advantage to those who actually want peace. Do you see it that way?
Well, let's hope it gives enough momentum. And I think we've got to go back beyond Trump. And this the old fantasy about collapse, of course, goes back, well, since the fall of the Soviet Union. And, of course, Obama's strategic patience was predicated on the idea that he didn't have to negotiate because North Korea would collapse. None of that, of course, has happened. And, I mean, you're quite right. What we're seeing now is basically an initiative from the North Korean side, and the basis of that is the success of the nuclear development of the nuclear deterrent. So they are now talking from a position of greater confidence than before, and obviously the sanctions are a huge burden. There's no getting around that, but we are now getting a sense of confidence coming out of North Korea, which we haven't seen in the past. And that that confidence has allowed them to move together with the South. So we have, as you say, this momentum. So we will be looking next month or so, seeing whether the forces in the United States can stop this, or whether it will become part of the new world order, that we will in fact have peace or certainly a diminution of tension in East Asia, and that's what I hope for. But then lots of people in Washington, of course, don't want that. That's not the way they look at the world and not the way they make their money.
Greg Ilich, the State Department is famously understaffed at this point. It's been just decimated of personnel under Rex Tillerson. There's no assistant secretary for East Asia. Only yesterday, Donald Trump named a new U.S. ambassador to South Korea. Is the State Department equipped to support these talks?
Well, I think Trump has difficulty separating State Department from Department of Defense. In his mind, foreign policy is military policy, and they go together. So as far as he's concerned, that's all you need. But I'm afraid that the signs are not encouraging if you look at who he's promoted. So Secretary of State Mike Pompeo one time was quoted as saying that Iran and North Korea cooperate in an evil partnership. And he's a bit of a loony on other issues as well. And of course, National Security Advisor John Bolton is notorious for his warmongering. But this the person that Trump wants to assign as ambassador to South Korea is Admiral Harry Harris, who's a well-known war hawk. So Stars and Stripes article quotes some sources as mentioning that Harry Harris has a preference for maximum pressure on North Korea and military strikes. He prefers that over diplomacy. So the kind of people that I think Trump is going to be sending along with him to negotiate with North Korea, I think he's thinking of it as still as capitulation. And of course, if you look at the quotes coming out of the White House, they're all about, well, we're not going to do a phased agreement with North Korea. They're not going to get anything until they completely denuclearize. It's basically the capitulation model, which is not going to work. And if you have a capitulation model, then what do you need diplomatic negotiators for, if that's your mindset?
That's absolutely right, I think. I'm not an expert on the Koreas, of course, and the three of you are, but that just seems to me to be a very logical position.
Yeah. Well, what's going to happen next, it would seem to me, is you have North Korea signifying to the people of South Korea, look, we don't want to be enemies. We're not the devils that you were, and people in South Korean schools were actually literally almost taught that North Koreans were devils. We're not devils. We're human beings. We're like you. In fact, we're Koreans. When you look at that meeting, that initial discussion between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un at the DMZ, I thought, well, these are two leaders of heads of state who don't need a translator. I mean, just that. I mean, it's that different. He's creating, or the North Koreans are creating an image in South Korea. At the same time, China is going to welcome this, even though the New York Times said China's unhappy because it's left out of the diplomacy and they're afraid that North Korea will become, along with South Korea, a new partnership with the United States. I think China's going to be happy. China's going to be happy. Russia's going to be happy. That means if the U.S. reneges on this or slows this down or sabotages it, it's more likely than not that China and Russia will find a way to maybe not formally but informally start to work against the same U.N. Security Council economic sanctions that they agreed to and allow trade to go forward. So North Korea is a winner thus. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, I'm seeing it the same way, too. I don't think the United States can count on the same cooperation or from Russia and China that it's gotten in the past on UN sanctions against North Korea. And China and Russia have very strong economic interests in an integrated Korean peninsula with their economies. So I do agree with you entirely that that's probably the direction it will move in. But then you might see mounting tensions between the United States and China and Russia, which could be proved dangerous on a different level.
There are mounting tensions, and we really haven't spoken about China very much, and certainly the media here in the States hasn't spoken about China much. But I wonder what the Chinese position on this is. I mean, everybody supports peace on the surface of things, but I wonder if the Chinese interests are the same as U.S. interests in the respect that a divided Korea may not be so bad for the Chinese and the Americans after all. Go ahead, whoever wants to take it.
Well, the Chinese certainly don't want to have a united Korea where American troops are occupying Korea.
Yeah.
That would be a serious security issue for China. But I think China is recognizing that the U.S.-Asia pivot is, as Greg said in the beginning and Tim agreed, directed against China, that North Korea was a pretext for more like a military escalation in that area. I think China is going to be looking at very favorably upon this. Anyway, Tim Beal, we're going to give you the last word. 1 minute left.
Yes, well, no, you're absolutely right. China and Russia both have an interest in peace and stability in Korea. China, I think, is got no great problems with a unified Korea. I mean, minor problems, but no great problems with the unified Korea as long as it's not just a U.S. client state. Japan is slightly different because I don't think Japan would like any form of united Korea because Korea would suddenly become quite a formidable competitor to it. And the United States, well, they've had their They're caught between two ways. On the one hand, they would like to take over the whole of the peninsula, destroy North Korea, et cetera, et cetera. But if they actually did that, and if they succeeded in doing that, then they have the problem of justifying their presence in Korea.
Okay, unfortunately, we are completely out of time. That was the voice of Tim Beal. Tim Beal is a professor in New Zealand. He's an author. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. We've also been joined from Columbus, Ohio, by Gregory Ehlich. He is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea, and he's the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
On our regular Friday segment covering the upcoming midterm elections, we take a look at a series of special elections that are on the calendar: a Republican win in Arizona and the possibility of Ohio Governor John Kasich running against Donald Trump in the Republican primaries. Lots of other things to talk about as well. We're joined here in the studio by Jacqueline Lukman and Abdus Lukman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks.
Let's start with this Arizona special election. It's funny. If you read the mainstream sort of left of center news sites, they say this was a great victory for the Democrats because it was a district that Donald Trump carried by 21 points. The Republican won by 5 points. The Democrat never really had a chance anyway. And that shows that people are angry with Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at Fox News or some of the conservative papers, they say a win is a win is a win, that this takes the wind out of the Democrats' sails. And it shows that this midterm election is going to be a lot closer than everybody has been saying, that there really is no blue wave. Let's start with Jacqueline. How about you? We'll start with you. What do you think of this?
I think this actually does portend doom. At least it spells trouble for the Republicans, because here is a district, like you said, that Trump won overwhelmingly. And the Democratic opponent was able to campaign. Dr. Hiral Tipirneni was able to campaign on some GOP-friendly kind of issues, like, she was pro-border security, but not funding a wall. She was a pro-Second Amendment with common sense gun reform. So she was able to convince a pretty loyal GOP voter base that she might be a viable option.
Mm-hmm.
And that ought to spell trouble.
And don't forget that, and we've said this before, but this district is the home of Joe Arpaio, the infamous sheriff from Maricopa County. This district also includes Sun City, which has one of the heaviest concentrations of wealthy retirees anywhere in America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been a solidly Republican district. So would you agree with Jacqueline that this really is a good thing for the Democrats, even though they lost this race?
Yeah, I think that the Republicans, even though they got this win, I think that they're not celebrating because of the margin that happened. And I think that Jacqueline—
And they're actually not celebrating.
Right. They're not celebrating.
After the articles the very day after the election, that was it. You don't hear anything else about
it. Right. Mm-hmm. And rightfully so, because now— it just shows that the Democrats have a high probability of winning the next time, you know. And even Lesko going to, her political capital is not going to be as strong, you know, as you see. You know, she doesn't have really have the support that they thought she was going to have.
Right. Well, there was a little scandal today, or not today, but this week within the Democratic Party, too. And it came out of a race in Colorado.
Little scandal?
Yeah, I think it ought to be a big scandal.
Yeah.
And what happened was there are several different Democrats competing in a race in Colorado, congressional race. Steny Hoyer, who's the minority whip, very long time Democratic congressman from Maryland. I think, frankly, he's been in the House of Representatives since the 1970s.
Yeah,
I think it's
time.
70s.
Mm-hmm.
He went out to Colorado to meet with the progressive candidate in this race and said, we want you to drop out, that we want the Wall Street Democrat, the neoliberal Democrat, to be the nominee. We want you to drop out. And this progressive, as was his right,
mm-hmm.
taped the conversation
mm-hmm.
and released it.
Now
what happens to the Democrats in Colorado?
Barry.
What happens to the Democrats in Colorado? I think the Democrats will probably win. That this is the thing that is so frustrating about this this scandal, that the Democrats will probably win this race. I think they have a good chance of winning, and them winning this race will be their justification for saying, see, this is why we have this strategy. But if you remember, after the 2016 election, you had Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton coming out telling people, well, if you don't like the outcome of the election, then get out there and collect some signatures and go vote. And Hillary was even pretty nasty about it when she was confronted with one of her constituents who was questioning her. So people did. So people actually did that.
Mm-hmm.
And they do what they are encouraged to do to get involved in the process, to push for greater representation in the party, for people like them, for progressive values, and they're shut down by the party.
And it's not just the party hierarchy that's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
This is happening in the press, too. I have a friend, he's been on this show, Arne Menconi is running for Congress in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And he recently participated in a candidate forum. And the next day in the local paper, it said that the three Democrats who participated in the candidate forum were two mainstream Democrats and a radical. Well, I know, right? Where do we even begin? Arn is a former elected official. He was a county commissioner. Mm-hmm. He ran a children's charity for 2 decades. But the press has decided that he's a radical, which makes him somehow not appropriate to be a Democratic nominee in one of these congressional races. And this is exactly what Steny Hoyer got caught doing.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And you know what really bothers me with the whole thing is that it just proves that the our own government is against democracy, you know.
Right.
And the fact that I think the Democrats have another problem, too. This whole thing of trying to woo the Bernie crowd, you know, this whole thing of trying to woo the progressives. And they just shot themselves in the foot with this. Another thing is also that that it also make them look ridiculous about the lawsuit that they filed.
Yes.
Against Trump and this whole, yes, you know, and the whole interference in elections. Well, what are they doing? You know, it just seems to me that, you know, they just make themselves look more and more ridiculous.
Exactly. I mean, they're interfering. And Nancy Pelosi saying that she agrees with this, that this is, you know, the policy.
Right.
That the DCC, the DCCC, basically has a right to throw all their support behind the candidate they think will win. But when you have grassroots mobilization of people entering the party who want to participate in the process, and the established a funding organization just out the door says, nope, not going to fund you, not even going to consider it.
Mm-hmm. Even if you're an incumbent, by the way.
Even if you're an incumbent. Exactly. So what does that say to not just progressives, but what does that really say to Democrats?
And, you know, they called this years ago the McGovernization of the party, right? Mm. The party had moved to the left and, oh, my gosh, we lost 49 states against Nixon in 72. We have to move the party to the right. Well, the party moved far to the right with the election of Bill Clinton in 1992 and that whole Democratic Leadership Council silliness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become entrenched on the right.
Yes.
To the point where the likes of Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, who call themselves progressives, are trying as hard as they can to keep the party on the right. Brian, would you agree with that?
Yes. Yes, I do. And, you know, it's like what the Democrats are doing is that they're warring against progressives, the Democratic establishment, against progressives in their party. And then people outside their party. And it's kind of an interesting thing when you think about it. You have, I'm looking at a David Axelrod tweet where he's condemning basically Jill Stein for existing. Now, Jill Stein is running independent of the Democrats. But here's the tweet. Jill Stein received 50,700 votes in Michigan. Trump won by less than 12,000. She outpolled Trump's margin in Wisconsin as well. If Russians sought to redirect alienated HRC voters to third parties, as indictment alleges, it was a shrewd ploy. So here you have David Axelrod condemning progressives who operate in the Green Party outside the Democratic Party.
Right.
But if you operate inside the Democratic Party and you actually also appear to be contending or winning, the same political establishment will use the same kind of, I'd say, BS demonizing approach towards those people, as if, you know, there should be a coronation of establishment Democrats. And if anyone interferes with the coronation, be they liberal Democrats like Bernie Sanders or Jill Stein, then they are marked for attack. And it's just as vicious. It's just as vicious as the attack from the Republicans.
And those mainstream Democrats don't understand that it's not an issue of, well, had Jill Stein not been in the race, all those Jill Stein voters would have voted for Hillary Clinton and Hillary would have won the election. That's just simply not true. When I was campaigning with Governor Gary Johnson before the 2016 election, I can't tell you how many of my friends and relatives criticized that I was going to help Trump. Trump was going to get elected. And I said that that's just not it. It's not an issue of helping Trump or helping Hillary or hurting either one of them. They said I was throwing away my vote and that I really needed to just pick the lesser of two evils. Well, the lesser of two evils is still evil.
Exactly.
Right.
And people just don't understand that it's that attitude that has made it in this country where we don't have viable third parties.
Yeah, and once again, I think, John, you brought it up. Once again, it's this role of the press in steering, you know, the attitudes of the people towards getting the candidates that we want. You know, they decide who is electable, who isn't electable. And they just muddied, to me, the whole democratic process.
You know, there was an episode of The Simpsons in 1996. I still remember it.
You're always quoting The Simpsons.
Because it's genius. It's work of genius. It was about the 1996 election, Clinton versus Dole. Well, two space aliens, Kang and Kodos, took over their bodies.
And you've actually memorized Simpson episodes.
Kang is my favorite character on The Simpsons.
And their brother and sister, even though their voices are exactly the same. So Kang and Kodos took over the bodies of Clinton and Dole. And during a presidential debate, they were unmasked. And so you saw that they were these green, one-eyed aliens with octopus legs.
Right.
And finally, somebody in the crowd shouted, "I'm going to vote for a third party." And Kang says, "Go ahead, throw away your vote." And that's what it's come down to in this country.
That's right.
That is what it's come down to. And you have the party that's supposed to be the quote unquote lesser of two evils, basically proving itself to be quite as evil as the other party, if not in policy, then definitely in their manipulation of the process and locking voters out of participating in democracy. If the Democrats are really concerned about people who vote for third party candidates, then have some better policies.
Yeah.
That really is just the beginning and the end of the discussion.
Set yourself apart.
Tell us why we should vote for you.
Exactly. Explain to the American voter why they should vote for you.
And not being Trump is not a reason.
No, that's it.
No.
That's it. Abdus, I want to change topics here. John Kasich, the soon-to-be outgoing governor of Ohio, has made several trips to New Hampshire, to Iowa, and to South Carolina, which all happen to be the earliest presidential primaries and caucuses. And this week, he made a private trip to Los Angeles, where he met with a billionaire donor by the name of Ron Burkle. Ron Burkle owns the Pittsburgh Penguins hockey team. Why would he do something like that?
Hey, he's testing the waters. You know, I always thought, even though I don't identify as a Republican, but I always thought that during the last election, during presidential election, I always thought that he was one of the sane ones. You know, I mean,
that's a very, very low bar.
It is.
but still, I think that again, I think he's one of those Republicans who see that he might have a shot. You know, he's out there testing the waters.
Well, the Los Angeles Times and CNBC and Bloomberg and a couple of other financial outlets reported on this, and they made the point of saying that Burkle has contributed millions and millions of dollars to causes from the left to the right and everything in between. He's not an ideological kind of person, and he's been very generous with Kasich over the years. But if Kasich is term limited, which he is,
right,
and he's out at the end of this year, then why does he need to talk to a billionaire super PAC guy unless he intends to challenge this president in the Republican primaries?
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. I think that's the reason why, the big reason why.
Yeah, and to piggyback on what you said, Abdus, there's a lot of support for Kasich as a Republican. I mean, the support is kind of conditional, you know, like you said. For a Republican, I like him. You know,
yeah.
And unfortunately, that's the danger of politics in the Trump era, that the bar is so low because of Donald Trump, that people who do still have questionable politics are seen as, okay, well, he's not so bad and I might be able to work with him. Not saying that all Republicans are horrible, but still, we have to admit that Trump has really, he didn't just set the bar low. He just broke it into pieces and it's lying on the floor now.
And I also think that a few Republicans are starting to see Trump as being vulnerable too.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I believe.
I think that's an important point. And you know, the Los Angeles Times said too that several interesting things came out of this. You know, politicians will always say, when they're asked, "Are you running for president?" They'll say things like, I intend to continue serving the people mm-hmm. of Ohio, blah, blah, blah. Well, Kasich, they asked him specifically, are you running for president? And he said, all of my options are on the table.
Oh,
that's
basic.
That's a political yes.
That means yes.
That means
yes, he's running for president.
That is a political yes.
And this Burkle, the billionaire, traditionally has been a Democrat. He gave generously. When I say generously, I mean his super PAC gave millions of dollars to Bill Clinton mm-hmm. through the 90s, to Hillary Clinton,
right.
and to Barack Obama.
And he contributed to Kamala Harris's campaign.
Indeed, he did.
Yeah. Yep.
Indeed, he did.
John Kasich is anti-choice. He's against yes. women controlling their own bodies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He wants, vocally.
He wants and promoted fracking on state lands in the state of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
He's right to work, which means smashing unions.
Destroying unions.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking. I guess the big left-wing, he supported, of course, the Keystone XL pipeline.
Of course
yes.
But he did sign a bill aimed at protecting Lake Erie's water quality. I mean, if that's
so, he's the environmentalist.
He's the environmentalist Republican.
And also he felt the EPA should not be involved in any sort of regulations designed to affect carbon emissions, which would be like the quintessential issue for mm-hmm. climate change.
And Ohio is a major manufacturing center of automobiles.
Right.
And he's for privatizing and has been privatizing the prison. So here we have again a situation in American politics where somebody like that is considered moderate.
He's the savior.
Right. Because he's not as crazy as Donald Trump.
Yeah. That's like having General James Mad Dog Mattis be the moderate, the peace stick in the Trump cabinet.
Right.
I mean, anyway, the thing, as the debate keeps shifting further and further and further to the right, everyone moves to the right. You know, I have to remind myself that when I heard Barack Obama's acceptance speech for the Democratic national nomination in 2008, I went back and I listened to some other acceptance speeches in the last 50 years just to compare them. And I listened to Richard Nixon's acceptance speech. That would have been 40 years earlier in 1968 at the Republican convention. Now, this is Richard Nixon, right-wing, anti-communist, racist, mm-hmm. law and order mm-hmm. guy. His speech accepting the nomination for the Republican ticket in 1968 was to the left of Obama's speech
wow.
in 2008. Whoa. And the reason was not because Obama, the person, is to the right of Nixon, the person. It's because the debate shift,
mm-hmm.
the political discourse yeah. shifted. In 1968, you had mass, urban rebellions in the United States. You had the French general strike. You had the Tet Offensive. You right. had the world was shifting to the left. America was shifting to the left. So even a right-wing anti-communist racist like Richard Nixon, when you listen to his speech, I invite our audience, go back and listen to the two speeches. It's to the left. And if Obama had said some of the things that Nixon said about why there should be peace with China and Soviet Union, for instance, mm-hmm. or things like that, Obama or certainly today, Trump would be castigated as some sort of traitor. But yeah. that's where we are right now. We're looking at politics. We always look at them in a short-term way because the immediacy of what's happening in front of us, like the upcoming election. But it is good to step back and see. Look through a different filter. How mm-hmm. are we now compared to, say, 50 years
ago? Well, there's a video going around on Facebook and Twitter right now. It's an old video from the 1990 Republican primary debates, and it shows a debate between Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, who was then running against him for the nomination. And they're in complete and total agreement on immigration, and their positions on immigration are that it's good. It's good for the country. We need to provide people a path to citizenship. All they want to do is to come here and work and support their families. They want to pay taxes, and we should help them get to that point. Well, that's anathema now to any Republican and to most Democrats, frankly,
oh, absolutely.
That are running
like,
for president.
When all of them say, this is an amnesty, we're not going to go back and do right. amnesty. That was Ronald Reagan's bill that he passed in 1986. What was before that? The Simpson-Mazzoli bill.
That's
I can't remember.
Simpson-Mazzoli.
Right.
But the 3 million undocumented people had a road to legalization. They had to go to English classes. They had to go to civics classes,
etc. Right.
You know, those things happened. And now the Democrats, when charged by Republican xenophobe, anti-immigrant racists, you're offering amnesty, meaning you're offering something like Ronald Reagan passed in 1986. The Democrats throw up their hands and say, no, we're not doing that.
And that goes back to your original point that the entire political discourse has moved to the right.
Right, because at that time in the 80s, those of us who were progressive and doing organizing and activists, in 1980 when Reagan was elected, we all thought, how could that possibly be? He's such a right-wing lunatic.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And now Ronald Reagan, by standards of today's, you know, mainstream politics, is not a right-wing lunatic.
He's a moderate.
He's a moderate, mm-hmm. which is crazy.
It's crazy.
Right.
Because he was Mr. Right-Wing, truly.
Same Reagan to the Republicans.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit, too. We only have about, I guess we have about 8 minutes left. Oh, we have less than that. We have 5 minutes.
Time is flying.
Yeah, time is flying. It always does
on
this segment.
Never enough time.
Let's talk real quickly about the West Virginia Senate race. We've spoken a couple of times about Don Blankenship. Don Blankenship was the CEO of a mining company. There was an accident at the mine, and nearly three dozen miners were killed. They were suffocated inside the mine. Blankenship went to federal prison for a couple of years and came out and still has millions upon millions of dollars, and he's trying to rehabilitate himself by running for the United States Senate. Well, there are two other Republicans running in that race, and this is the race to challenge former governor, current Senator Joe Manchin. Blankenship's not even been invited to the debates, right? Donald Trump went to West Virginia a couple of weeks ago and did a fundraiser for the two Republicans running against Blankenship, and Blankenship wasn't even invited to the dinner. So here we have a situation where Blankenship really is out of the mainstream. He's a convicted felon, but he's willing to spend as much as $30 million of his own money to run this race.
He should give that money to the families of the miners
who
died.
You bet he should.
Because they died as I mean, that man should have gone to prison for a lot longer.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
He should still be there.
He should still be in prison. But he's using that money to even advertise in the prohibitively expensive Washington, D.C. market. And the D.C. channels really don't even cover that much of West Virginia. The Pittsburgh channels do. Cumberland, Maryland channels do, but not Washington. But he's buying that time because he has the money. Is this a real race? Does he have a real chance of winning this Republican nomination?
I don't know that he has a chance of winning the Republican nomination. The thing that is disturbing is that he does have support. I don't know that it's enough support to win him this race. But I do believe that the way he's been advertising himself and trying to rehabilitate his image and paint himself as the victim.
Yeah, he's the victim.
In fact, one of his ads says that 7 of the 10 rights in the Bill of Rights were violated in his case.
That's what he said. And he knows that that kind of language gets the attention of a certain group of people. So he does have support among that very far right, maybe libertarian leaning Republican base. And because he is outside of the mainstream, you've got this interesting nexus of people who are opposed to Trump. I mean, GOP voters who are opposed to Trump, but who are also opposed to mainstream Republicans, establishment Republicans.
Yeah.
So Blankenship is like they're weird. I don't know, like they're weird Pied Piper. I don't even know how to describe him. It's such a weird thing.
I got to add, too, and I want to ask you, Abdus, he's decided to run an overtly racist campaign, and he's couching this in terms of opposing Mitch McConnell. So Politico reported yesterday that Blankenship has been crisscrossing the state of West Virginia, just yelling about McConnell, calling him weak-kneed, accusing him of failing to stand up for the coal industry, saying that he has lost touch years ago with Republican voters. And then he took out an ad saying that McConnell is in the pay of China, that he, quote, has a lot of connections to China, adding that McConnell's wife, who is Donald Trump's Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, is from China. And he says, quote, so we really have to be concerned about the truth, unquote. And he neglects to say that his own girlfriend is Chinese and she's from China. She's actually a Chinese citizen. You think this racism plays in West Virginia?
All of it's despicable, but I think that Blankenship is trying to take a page out of Trump's book, and to the fact that he is going to, you know, he's trying to take a page out of Trump's book. And to your point, Jackie, I think the fact that he isn't going to be successful, because even though he's appealing to the far fringes of these right wing crazies, he doesn't have the support where it really counts.
And that is within the party.
Right.
That's within the party itself. Right. And that does matter. That really does matter.
By the way, I think we're all missing the biggest story here about West Virginia, which is, I'm looking at Bloomberg, and this is about the 2018 election. Russians want to hack our elections, call out the National Guard.
Oh, yes.
West Virginia's top election official, Republican Secretary of State Mack Warner, has embedded a member of the Air National Guard in his office to scour election networks daily. Short on funds and expertise, a number of Warner counterparts across the country are also tapping the National Guard to bolster their cybersecurity before November's elections. The threat is real.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Let's mobilize the National Guard in West Virginia to stop the Russians.
To stop the Russians from
because
hacking
NSA
up.
Can't do it. And the NSA's cyber command can't do it.
They can't do it
because it doesn't exist. Right. Never mind that.
But that's the story.
But the West Virginia Secretary of State is going to have an Air National Guardsman do
it. And by the way, in terms of Blankenship, I mean this mass murderer from not my point of view, from the point of view of the families. That's what they call him.
That's right.
I don't want to get in trouble here. They say he's a murderer.
Indeed.
Right.
He went to prison for a year. But, you know, investigators couldn't go into Massey Energy mines that killed those miners for 2 months because the toxic level was so high. They couldn't enter that mine for 2 months. And Massey Energy, under Blankenship's leadership, had routinely been found to have committed violation after violation after violation. They don't care about the lives of working people.
No. They were fined dozens of times.
Yeah, and they only care about profits. And this guy gets a slap on the wrist, 1 year in prison, and all of these families still mourning. And he's got so much money, he can waste it on this ridiculous run where he accuses Mitch McConnell, arch right wing, whatever he is, of being some sort of leftist, maybe a stooge, maybe the Manchurian candidate of the Politburo of the People's Republic of China.
Amazing. It's amazing that our politics has gone full circle to McCarthyism 2018.
Yeah, it's true. Well, goodness knows, we're going to have a lot to talk about next week. We were joined from Washington here in the studio by Jackie Lukman and Abdus Lukman. They are the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.